Welcome to the Goodness Podcast, the Middle East's first platform dedicated to tackling women's health in a real and honest way. I'm your host, Noor Tahini. Welcome back to my conversation with Dr. Sheethal Kinney, a relationship therapist based in Dubai. If you missed parts one or two, hit stop and head back to episodes 34 and 35 of the Goodness Podcast. Otherwise, enjoy this episode. Another question that we got was, do some marriages have an expiration date? And is a marriage really forever?
So there's something that I didn't share before, which is actually a concept that will make sense in this context and also with some of the other questions that we've talked about. In any relationship, we need to have what we call a secure attachment to our partner. Okay? A secure attachment, a secure emotional attachment to our partner consists of two variables. We need the right amount of togetherness and the right amount of autonomy. Usually when we think about attachment, we only think about togetherness. But really, the ideal secure relationship is one where I know you're with me, but I can be my own person as well. Mm-hmm. I don't have to be you. You and I don't have to coincide. You don't have to intersect. We can be our separate people, but I can still feel like you're always there for me. And usually, in order to survive, and this has been done, this research has been done as to why human beings, we need secure attachment. We need attachment to an individual in our lives. And because of this, usually we prefer having monogamous relationships, even though in nature it may not have seemed like the go-to thing to do. Because if I have a secure attachment that makes me feel stable, that makes me feel secure, you know, happy with myself. And in thinking about when relationships go south, it's when we have different kinds of attachment styles. So a secure attachment style is where, as I told you, there's a balance of autonomy and togetherness. The insecure, preoccupied, there are two types of insecure attachments. There's a preoccupied attachment and there's an avoidant attachment. With preoccupied attachment, I'm constantly preoccupied with the relationship. I'm very anxious about losing my partner. And so I hold on too tight. And I would rather be like this all the time. So imagine if a secure attachment is at X amount of distance, the anxious attachment, the preoccupied, does not like that. Whereas the avoidant requires extra space in the relationship and always keeps their partners at like a distance. And even if you think about people you've known, there's some people who are extremely clingy in relationships, and there's some people who are extremely like, I don't want to see distant. You every day. Mm. Extremely distant, yes. And so when it's someone who's really clingy, they're preferring togetherness over autonomy. And when someone is being extremely avoidant, they're preferring autonomy over togetherness. Now, the reasons why they do that is because of their own childhood and their experiences and da-da-da-da. But if you think about the healthy recipe for what we need in terms of a relationship, we want to feel like there's security and togetherness, but we also want to feel like there's an element of adventure, unpredictability, novelty, right? We want mm-hmm. both. And they're actually kind of opposing needs. And Esther Perel talks a lot about this, that, you know, our emotional needs and what she calls our erotic needs, which is our sort of, which is not actually related to physical intimacy necessarily, but the needs that we usually associate a lot with physical intimacy are quite opposite. We want excitement when we think about physical intimacy. We want novelty. We want adventure. We want unpredictability. But at the same time, when we think about having a partner, we want stability. We want predictability.
Mm-hmm. So what's the solution?
So the solution is, first of all, understanding that our emotional and our erotic needs are polar opposite. Mm. And sometimes we need to understand that it's not going to be easy, that both are going to come that easily with the same partner. So it's almost a thing that expecting fidelity and expecting that I'm going to be fulfilled and have the right balance of autonomy and togetherness with this person forever, just naturally. That's what we do, right? We expect that once you're married, naturally, that's going to work. And the exception is to cheat. The exception is to look outside. The exception is divorce. In fact, what Esther says is the exception is to naturally find it.
Mm.
We actually have to do extra work to keep that balance between autonomy and togetherness, to keep that balance between security and unpredictability, to keep that balance between sameness, routine, and novelty. And if we don't put all that work, the expiration date comes sooner.
Can you give some examples of what that work looks like?
So, for example, you know, sometimes, first of all, we need to figure out, you know, what we're more comfortable with. There might be one partner who, and usually attachment styles matter so much in terms of compatibility. The most difficult type of relationship is when you have an anxiously attached person, the preoccupied type of person who is married to an avoidant person. There's constant tug of war. There's constant push and pull. One person wants all the space. One person cannot tolerate it at all. So before we go into thinking about how do we balance the two, we need to understand where do we stand individually? What is our preference? And when we act the way we do, are we pushing our partner away by the way we're acting? Are we bringing them closer to us? What's actually happening between us? Once we take the example of two securely attached individuals, it's not taking the relationship for granted. So in one of the systems in the relationship mold I was talking about, so the friendship system, the first level of that house, of the sound relationship house, is called building love maps. And a love map is kind of what a map does. It's like your navigational tool to understanding your partner's internal world. Okay? Imagine how much time and effort we put into building the map initially when we meet the other person. Where are you from? Tell me about your parents. Tell me about your best friend. Oh, what kind of movies do you like? Blah, 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 blah. There's so much intrigue. There's so much interest. What happens 1 year down the relationship? Oh, well, I know you. Moving on. There's that intrigue and the, okay, you know, what else has happened to you today? Or how has life changed for you this year than like last year? Or, you know, things that actually keep our intrigue alive about the other person. The newness, the novelty, the interest in developing and updating that map. That is an example of not taking the relationship for granted and actually keep depositing, as I said, into the other person's account.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is also when you think about, you know, romance and actually talking about what romance means to you, taking breaks from each other, where you're doing things that are, you know, your own interests, but then coming together and sharing that with each other, not always having to do everything together, but being able to tolerate some distance in the relationship, being able to do something new together, and really investing in finding out what is going to excite the other person. It's rare that we talk about these things, nor because I think we believe that these things should happen naturally. It's really awkward. Mm. You know, you should just know how to sweep me off my feet, and you should just see me and feel your heart racing. You know, it's like, no, it just doesn't work like that. We have to actually ask each other and have that intrigue in making that happen for each other.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking while you were talking that couples wait until they're married and things don't go well to go to therapy together and figure out, are their attachment styles different or the same? Are their non-negotiables different or the same? And I was thinking, yeah. There should be, it should become sort of common practice for couples to go to therapy before they get married.
I could not agree more. I was thinking this the same. As you know, I am expecting, so like I'm going to be a mom soon, and I was thinking about all the parenting classes that are out there, and you know, obviously with COVID we have to do everything virtually, and now it's become kind of common practice to do these, you know, either, I know a lot of people go to birthing classes, but a lot of people go to just like parenting 101 classes, you know, like how to put a swaddle together and how to, you know, basics of how to keep your child alive. and these things are now encouraged and completely normal, because it is actually now a science and you know these things. And similarly, I think just as you're nurturing this new child that needs your support and you need to learn how to nurture it, I think when you're getting married, you do need support and knowledge on how to nurture it. And I think it would be great if it was part of, you know, a marriage license, is you've taken X amount of premarital classes and you need that before.
Yeah, that would be awesome. You touched a little bit on physical intimacy, so let's go there. How sure. important is sex to a relationship, and can a relationship be sustained without sex?
Honestly, for the most part, I think most relationships would not be able to sustain without sex. I know that there are people who, I know it's probably a minority, who would classify themselves as asexual and do not have the need for sex, but I think barring those individuals, if you're talking about someone who has sexual needs and is not having a sexual relationship with their spouse or their partner, then that can be very damaging to the relationship.
I also read the other day how sex, when you meet someone and you first start having sex with them, the hormone that is created in your brain is dopamine. So it's very exciting. It's that rush. It's like, And it's a feeling that I think most people will remember very well. And then in long-term relationships, it changes so that, what's it
oxytocin.
Called? Oxytocin. Oxytocin, yeah. So oxytocin is the hormone or neurotransmitter that is produced. So actually, it's a hormone. And basically, what oxytocin is used for is creating a bond, a feeling of wanting to build a life together. So actually, sex serves like an actual tangible purpose in helping you stay with someone longer.
Yes, it's evolutionary psychology. It's amazing, you know? Yeah. Funnily enough, they used to say that there was this thing called the 7-year itch or the 5-year itch, and we've heard about it, that most relationships kind of people start to get bored or people start to lose interest after the 5 to 7 year mark. And what evolutionary psychology says is that it's really a product of adaptation, that two people would stay together long enough for their young one to reach an age of 5 to 7 years old so that they are well enough or independent enough to then, you know, they don't need both parents there.
Wow.
And so that's why they're together, the hormones and the emotions last that long, at least to secure the child raising. Pretty cool.
Because back in the day, thousands of years, couples were not expected to stay together longer than
exactly.
Yeah, there's a few aspects of modern marriages that I've heard kind of go against our maybe like the way we were built to function or things like that. And one of those things is monogamy. Mm-hmm. So I had a therapist that told me once that actually, monogamy doesn't come naturally to humans, and yet it is such a foundational block for so many marriages. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, if you think about the two variables I was talking about, right? Togetherness and autonomy. With monogamy, we really are choosing security and stability over our need for adventure, novelty, excitement. We have both sets of needs. So we are actually choosing one set of needs over the other, because on some level, it has shown perhaps that it gives us better health in the long term. It's safer for us. It's ironic because on one hand, it feels like it's not really evolutionarily adaptive or sort of natural to be monogamous. But on the other hand, I think it does give us survival advantages in this day and age. technically speaking, people say that, you know, this is not technically, I mean, this is research that has shown that people who are in marriages and long-term marriages and happy marriages, they live 4 years longer than people who are single. They take better care of their health when they're married. There's so many factors to why we choose this. But I think that's the whole point here, is that we're choosing it. It's not necessarily a given. We treat it like the second you sign those papers, the second, you know, you say I do, that we're just going to magically shift our mind. And
make
we're
it
not,
work forever.
Yeah, and that, you know, emotionally, we're just going to always want that person and always have that passion and always just everything that we needed is going to come naturally. And that's the part that if we can just tweak our mindset and believe that, no, this is a choice. You're actually you're doing something which is kind of an exception, but it's a workable exception. And here's all the things you're going to have to do to make that exception work. That change in mindset, I think, would definitely shift a lot of the ways in which we treat marriage.
There's another question we got, which I liked a lot, which is it possible to find sexual attraction and fulfillment, companionship and partnership in one person? Or are we asking for too much?
This is exactly about that opposing needs theory, right? That I think the expectation is that the person who is going to get me feeling all excited and passionate and fulfill me sexually is the person who's also going to be my soulmate and my emotional core and my security and da-da-da. Now, if you think about it, I mean, I'm going to go based on a cliche here, but, you know, people talk about girls having a bad boy phase. You've heard about that?
Yeah. I had a bad boy phase.
Who hasn't? And it's funny because the bad boy phase actually represents our choice for the latter of the two needs. It's when we're choosing adventure, unpredictability, and excitability. And usually most women will say, we had a bad boy phase and now we chose the good guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because then we choose the security, the stability, the emotional variables that we need. Right? Actually, they're both emotional variables, but I would say the togetherness variables as opposed to the autonomy variables. Because the togetherness variables, it's like the very fact that it's two people means it's not going to be just about me. I'm going to have to be more flexible. I'm going to have to be more accommodating. I'm going to have to be part of a unit as opposed to just thinking about me, which is that adventure side of me, the unpredictability, the da-da-da. So first of all, I think if it's movies or where we see this, but the idea that the needs are going to be met by the same person naturally forever is highly mistaken. I think most times you will pick the person because they meet one or the other set of needs more. And you will know that somewhere.
What do you do about the other needs?
That's where you work on them. That's where you don't think that it should just be there. And I think that's the problem, is we're so disappointed because it's just not there naturally.
So they naturally meet one set, and then with work, they can come to meet the other set.
Yes. And probably in the beginning of the relationship, they meet both.
Yeah.
Because the novelty is definitely there. And if you're choosing someone because they're stable, secure emotionally, then you're getting both in the beginning. So it's really exciting on both fronts. But then over time, maybe you lose out on one or the other, naturally speaking.
Okay. I have two more questions for you. Mm-hmm. Yes, two more questions. I realize that I've had you on here for almost 2 hours.
So I knew that the topic, it was like really interesting, and there's a lot to cover on it.
Yeah. All right. So the two more questions that I have here. The first one is it okay to take time out of a marriage? If so, how do you do that?
So are you talking about like a...
like a break.
A break? Trial separation?
I don't know. What's trial separation?
So a lot of couples who have been going through a tough time will, prior to getting divorced or getting separated, will do a trial separation for like a month or two. They get separate apartments. They start kind of seeing what it feels like to live separately. Honestly, I always think it depends on what mindset you've kind of gone into it with. If there are people who go into it with the mindset that I'm just using this as a soft landing to help me transition into what will be the rest of my life, that ship is kind of almost sailed. There are some people who go into it with the intention of, this has been too much conflict and it's overwhelmed me so much. I've lost sight of what I want and who I am. And I want space and I want to, you know, use this as a time to regroup. But I think what matters is, what are you doing in that time apart? When it works is when I've seen couples who maybe move out, when it's become very traumatic, the relationship has become very traumatic, they have actually moved out into separate places, but then they start dating again. They're not living together anymore.
They date each other.
Yes, yes. So with couples therapy, they are kind of learning how to come close again together. Now, I wouldn't actually ideally ever recommend this to people in general when they're going through counseling. Like, this is very rare. It's usually when there's a lot of volatility in living in the same space, and it's easier to kind of get a little bit of breathing room and be more gentle and fragile, you know, treating with fragility, really, the relationship, and then kind of building up to something solid. If that answers your question.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. Just to end things, the last thing that I wanted to ask you was, if marriage was created, you know, thousands of years ago in a completely different time, could you argue that perhaps we're trying to force an archaic structure in a modern world? Like, do you think that marriage has not evolved enough yet to keep up with our lives, or would you argue that it has?
I think marriage has evolved a lot. Maybe not fast enough, but I think for the longest time, if I think about from what I remember, marriage was ruled a lot by a lot of patriarchy. A lot of rules around the expectations, gender roles. It meant something different before. And the kind of stuff that we discussed in the beginning of our session today. And to think of how it has evolved now, I think so many factors have resulted in its evolution. So whether it is, you know, women's equality, the sexual revolution, globalization, modernization, to the point where now I think we have come to a place where we are choosing our partners. We are also allowing ourselves to leave the relationship when we want to. People are talking about open marriages. There are polyamorous relationships. I mean, marriage has evolved in so many sort of ways. I think what happens is it's a bit confusing when we have old and new happening at the same time. So even though we have a lot of modern marriage today, we still see in our world, in our environment, people who are living sort of the more archaic institutions of marriage, people who are following that same expectation or the rules of conduct of what marriage used to look like. But I think today really two people can agree to anything in a marriage.
Yeah.
And I think that's quite evolved. Yeah.
I feel like I was telling my husband the other day, I feel like our generation is really reinventing what it means to be in a marriage and what it means to have a marriage work for you.
And maybe some of it is informed by research. Some of it is I think we're still figuring out a lot. There's a lot of experimentation happening right now. And I think with freedom comes the option to experiment. And I think people learn either way, whether something works, whether something doesn't work For example, you know, only in recent years, the concept of open marriages, for example, has come up, and there's not a lot of research out there on whether they work or they don't work. A lot of the evidence is anecdotal. So we're kind of in a phase where we're still determining, you know, where is this going to go? And yeah. how else is it going to evolve into? But at least I can comment on, you know, whatever research has been done in the last 40 years or 50 years in most monogamous marriages, what works and what doesn't work. But because of experimentation now, we're seeing new models of marriage come up, and only time will tell, you know, what works and that what doesn't work in that.
Yeah. Yeah. On the topic of open marriages, what I've heard most experts say, not experts in open marriages, but experts in relationships say, is that in their experience, it's not something that really succeeds, because it depends greatly on where you are in your relationship when you enter into an open marriage. So in general, couples enter into open marriage agreements because things are not going well. But if they enter into an agreement like this at the peak of their relationship, when things are going so well and they just want to, I don't know, add a little bit of spice or something, then chances of it succeeding are much higher. Is that your experience as well?
Absolutely. Because at the end of the day, it's all about the intention. Yeah. So if I am entering an open marriage when I'm unhappy, my intention is escapism. Right? Is I don't want to deal with what I'm unhappy about. Let me find something that makes me happy. But I also don't want to deal with the reality of the situation that my marriage is failing. So I'm just going to kind of be a little bit in denial of it. It's a little bit of escapism, right? Whereas if I am choosing the open marriage at a time where I'm really happy, it means that the concept of open marriage in my mind is not actually dependent on my partner. It's a concept that I'm open to regardless of who I'm with. And I would like to bring that to this wonderful relationship that I'm in right now.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure having you. Thank you for giving me 2 hours of your time. We're definitely going to have to put this out in installments so that people can digest all the amazing information that you just shared. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you. You too, Noor. Bye.
Thanks for listening today. If you're not familiar with Goodness, head to www.goodness.me to access the online platform and articles, and follow us at Goodness on Instagram. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate, review, and share it, and we'll see you next week.